This is Four People with Bishop Rob Wright.
Welcome to Four People with Bishop Rob Wright. I'm your host, Melissa Rao, and today we're delighted to have a special guest with us, the Reverend Barbara Brown Taylor. Barbara, welcome.
Thank you, Melissa.
For those of you who may not know her, Barbara Brown Taylor is the New York Times best-selling author of An Altar in the World, Learning to Walk in the Dark, and Holy Envy, Finding God in the Faith of Others. She's been an Avon lady, a cocktail waitress, a horseback riding instructor, and a hospital chaplain. But her favorite job, according to her, was teaching world religions at Piedmont College for 20 years. Before putting the chalk down in 2017, Barbara's also a priest in the Diocese of Atlanta, and we're glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Barbara.
Just to get us started, what is your favorite image of God and why?
Every time I'm asked that question, I ask if I can get back to you in about a month, because it has, you know, I think I'm going to go the way of the via negativa, which is to tell you what the image is not. It's not male. It's not white. Doesn't look like a giant human being with big, big toes. It has evolved past image for me to something closer to consciousness or cellular totality or the space between the stars. In other words, the image is not so much an image as it is the connective tissue of the cosmos, of the air that knits humans and all living things together. And that doesn't work in much liturgy to try to talk about that. A little bit in Eucharistic prayer C maybe, but that that is where I am. In other words, I'm never absent, never apart from, never not in that luminous web. Luminous web is the way I talked about it once. So that's my prevailing sense of the divine, the sacred.
Hmm. Bishop, I have to say, one of my favorite episodes that we did, I think it might have been in Just God, but you were talking about one of your favorite things to do is when you're reading the Bible, that you will write out the traits of God that you recognize in the story. And I'm curious if you have an answer to that question based upon what you think your image of God is.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate how Barbara started that off. Excuse me. Mine is not as poetic, but I think maybe there's a lot of overlap. You know, I was never an Avon lady, though. Perhaps I should have been. But I did have and still argue that the most spiritual job I ever had was working for a landscape company as I was working my way through college. And you know, I'll never look at soil and seed and sunshine and water again the same way. But we laid a lot of sod, you know. This is grass grown elsewhere, and then we smoothed the ground over and then laid the sod down. But if you turn the sod over, not on the green part, but on the brown part that eventually connects to the earth, you see this radical connectivity, right? And so when Barbara says the space between the stars and this radical connectivity bit, I totally get that, and I get that, you know, it's you're forever located in it. That, you know, it's like Psalm 139. Where can you go that God is not already? Right. I mean, it's a bit hard to preach, maybe easier to write about, but I feel located, and I think that's the best part of spiritual maturity is that when you get down there, and you realize that God is within and without, but and all around, you get located. And I feel like that gives us an opportunity for some maturity, for especially how we deal with one another, because I'm radically related to you, whether we know it or act like it. I don't know if that's quite an answer, but Barbara, would you add anything to that, or is there any story from Scripture that points you in that direction?
Oh no, I love that. Don't ask me for scriptural backup right now, but no, I love the image of the sod. That's wonderful. I feel accompanied. See, my word is accompanied. So located works a lot. And I also don't think we should get into divine sovereignty right now, but I do think that's what's difficult for some people is how is, you know, with sod or connective tissue as image, it's hard to square that with teachings about the one who makes all the decisions, you know, and moves things around and makes things happen. But we can come back to that later. At this moment, I think the idea of divine sovereignty makes more atheists than anything else I can think of, because it raises the whole question of why did God do this to me? I'm not going to believe in God anymore. So.
Wow. That, you know, it's a big question, really. I was actually trying to chew on it myself. And what is the image of God to me? I bet every single person we ask this question to, someone's going to say something completely different. And I find that to be part of God's image. God is all powerful. God is everywhere. And God shows up also in the most ridiculously extraordinarily mundane. Barbara, one of your quotes is, "Hello, I'm Barbara Brown Taylor. I say things you're not supposed to say." So I'm curious, what are some of the things a woman, priest, follower of Jesus, and American are not supposed to say?
Well, Melissa, I have 4 books that I'm I think my vocation from the time I was little, I just didn't have good social graces. You know, my mother didn't teach me important things and my dad worked all the time. So I grew up just asking people how much money they made and, you know, asking them all kinds of stuff I wasn't supposed to ask. And when I became first a preacher and then a writer, what I heard most often was, "Thank you for saying what I've always thought, but couldn't put it into the right words." And I thought, oh, that's my vocation. I had no idea. I'm just supposed to go ahead and blurt out stuff that other people are thinking, but are concerned for one reason or another to say. So, you know, the other part of that tagline on the website is just being a spiritual contrarian, which to me means pay attention to which direction the crowd is facing and turn around and look the other way, because there's a lot of neglected stuff back there. So contrarian just means, you know, doing a 180 or a 90 degree regularly to turn around and see where the attention is not going and go there. Learning to walk in the dark, that was really intentional, because darkness is such a great big grab bag of associations for a lot of people. So I could get into each of your questions about, you know, women, Americans, et cetera, but mostly it's just like holding a finger up to the wind and then paying attention to where the wind is coming from instead of where it's blowing to.
You know, that I mean, we sort of think of the prophets in the Bible as you know, big old finger waggers or, you know, those sorts of folks. But, you know, a definition that has come to me is the people with heightened sensitivity for the pain that's in their midst and who have to give it voice. But there's this other piece, which is, you know, we have to say, the prophet is someone who gets to say what we say at the beauty shop and what we say at the barbershop, but in public. Right. You know, I think that there's a lot of things we don't want to pay attention to because it's easier for the system to not pay attention to. And so, yeah, I don't know how we teach that, but I wish we could teach that more. This sort of, you know, we all do a bit of hurting. That's just sort of what it means to be a human being, one with the other. But you know, Jesus does this again and again. He turns around and looks at some stuff. As Brueggemann says, you know, his spirituality is driven by the facts on the ground. And so we've got to do that a bit more. We've got to be a little bit more curious. I think that might be the most spiritual gift that I would want for people, is be more curious. You know, I the silver lining for COVID-19, I don't know what your silver lining for COVID-19 is, Barbara. You know, mine has been to really, over these last 5 months, take a look at how all of the running around from pillar to post really gives short shrift to the actual spiritual leadership work that I'm supposed to do, which is to begin to sit in a new way with a new commitment to quietness, and to look back at some of the stuff that we're sort of running roughshod over. And so while COVID-19 has been a gut punch to the economy and into people's lives, and the grief and loss is real and legitimate, there's been this upside, as it occurs to me, for for people of faith to sort of maybe do a reevaluation and maybe even an attic clean. So I wonder what this last couple of months has been like for you in terms of that.
Oh, well, that's at the top of my list. In fact, I wish we could revise the seven deadly sins now. I don't know, take one off and put on busyness or just make it eight. But I do find I'm not ticklish about talking about the silver lining, because we hear so much about the other, but a great deal of revelatory stuff has happened in the last 5 months. Now, I should add the caveat, I'm retired. I can live on my pension. I have no children at home. I can grow my own food, and I can still lift a 50-pound bag of horse feed. So there are a lot of reasons, you know, for there to be more silver lining here than there is in other ways of being. But the exploration of inner space, you know, versus the destinations in the car I need to get to before one so I can be back and do the next thing and the next thing. These 5 months have given me a different relationship to time. At the beginning, leisure, and then the leisure turned into harder inner work, really wonderful inner work, the kind of inner work that an extended Sabbath offers when you get real rested and then you think, and now who am I and why am I here? And wait a minute, my identity was hooked to all that busyness. So who am I now? So that's top of my list.
I recently listened to the Reverend Dr. Reggie Williams from McCormick Theological Seminary in Chicago. Dr. Reggie Williams, he's the author of the book Bonhoeffer's Black Jesus, Harlem Renaissance Theology and an Ethic of Resistance. And the reason why this illustration came to mind is because of what you had said earlier about being contrary and turning in the other direction. We have had a lot of revelations as an entire society over the last 5 months. And Dr. Williams has this really great imagery of being in a whirlpool. You know how there's kind of like you're in a pool and you go in the same direction and it creates this kind of vacuum, you know, like a whirlpool, literally. And then he said, what we need to do is turn around and fight the current. And that just imagery that just came to mind when you were talking about being contrary, because that's a lot easier said than done. And it's something you've done your entire life. And so it's something that I really appreciate. So thank you for that great example.
Mm. Thank you for the book. I'm going to order that as soon as we're finished.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
You know, Barbara, go ahead, please. No, please.
Nope.
I was going to say, you know, one of the things I admire about you is that you're sort of a country girl now, so to speak, if I can say that. You live on a farm, and I've enjoyed the books where you share details about the dark night there without the street lights and all the street noise, et cetera. And I'm a city boy. So, you know, I grew up believing that trees should be in a park, but, I go for a walk down by the Chattahoochee most mornings. And, you know, you talk about these revelations beyond leisure. And it was fascinating to watch the geese stand against the current and wait for the current to bring them what they needed. And so when I think about your comment, that's what I think is that, you know, there's an abiding trust that gets nurtured, and maybe even grown and deepened in times like this. We wait for and learn to wait and learn to understand the benefits of waiting for providence, whatever you want to call it, spirit, for the current to bring us those things that are sustaining. We talk about the work. You talked a little bit about the work. I wonder, what's been the joy of the revelation? What's been the joy of the work that you've done, you know, in the interior realm? Because I think that we need to talk about that part of it as well. I think what sustains us when we do that work is that the revelation that does accrue to joy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I have a long list. So deep rest was such a surprise, to sleep through the night, to not clench my jaws as much. And that was just about not having deadlines. I mean, every event I had for this year was canceled. So I'm not only retired, but unemployed. And a deep rest came in, and also a care for my home and my garden and my husband and my family and the animals I've collected here that I have neglected for years in the name of that busyness. So it's hard to defend the love and the joy in the domestic arts, you know, taking the basket of vegetables Ed brings me and making a dinner of it. And we sit down at the table and they're just two of us, but we used to sit and watch television while we ate. And now we sit and eat together. And there's been such joy in that. I've dug 97 holes on Monday since you used to work in the landscape. I planted some rhododendron and native azalea. And to go serious on you, the closer I get to becoming the dust from which I came, the more I love digging in the dirt. And this sounds real familiar to, you know, for people my age, but I'm in my late 60s and playing in the dirt has become like hanging out with the kin. So the groundedness has given me a lot of joy. Intergenerational friendships. I have more in common with people 20 and sometimes 30, even 40 years younger than I am than I ever did when I call up and say, so how's your life changed? We've got more to talk about than we ever have. So there's a long list of joys as well. And you're right, we do need to talk about that. We make it all sound hard and terrible. And the inner work is full of joy.
It has been sustaining. My kids, I do have kids here, and they're heading off now in various ways. But my wife and I were acknowledging that the truth of this, we wouldn't have been that close together for the last 5 months were it not for COVID, right? Mm-hmm. And to be enmeshed in people's rhythms and in a way that we have been over the last 5 months, it wouldn't have happened. I mean, we would have done it through FaceTime and emails and text messages, but you know, after we sort of got some of that negotiated at the front end, there was a lot of joy to it. There were common meals and simple things, you know. We said morning prayer every Sunday together as a family. I'm pretty sure that would not have happened otherwise. And as the designated preacher, I got to, you know, shut up and listen to young people tell me how they were making sense of those parables right now with the violence on television and with all the no's in the society. So, there are those joys, but, you know, it's quite a commentary that we had to be forced to slow down, mm-hmm. right, and become more human.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, I'm going to take us in a completely. Go ahead, if you've got.
I was just going to say that's
please.
Such an interesting flip that I think a lot of people can identify with is if you have a close family circle, there's more incarnational, you know, flesh and blood time with them, while there's less with, you know, the circles of human beings as they get further away. So many people have got Zoom fatigue, but with the family, you're right, that the simple pleasures of being together in the same place have had a chance to blossom. Go ahead, Melissa.
I wonder what that's about. Well, no. I wonder what that's about, though. Sometimes I feel like when we are being threatened, that sometimes our circle is going to get naturally smaller. We're going to pull in. Maybe it's a form of self-protection. And maybe I'm just being ridiculous, but I feel like, thank God for our nuclear family and those people that we're closest to, that we can hunker down and weather the storm together, and that we come out of it all the stronger because of those relationships that we have and protect. So we'll talk more about God when we're back with four people after a short break.
This is Four People producer Easton Davis inviting you to Imagine Church, a brand new initiative and expression of worship. The joyful worship you're listening to now is Shonda Lee, resident musician for Imagine Church. This worship experience takes what we believe to be the very best parts of Episcopal worship and creates a fully online intimate experience using professional audio and visual equipment, all in under 25 minutes. Worship with us and Bishop Wright the fourth Sunday evening of every month at 7 p.m. More information at imaginechurch.online. We look forward to seeing you there. Now back to Four People.
Welcome back to Four People with Bishop Rob Wright. I'm going to take us in a completely different direction, if y'all don't mind. Barbara, I have a list of quotes that you have. And so I hope it's okay that I share them with you and ask follow-up questions. This is a great quote. "The problem is many of the people in need of saving are in churches. And at least part of what they need saving from is the idea that God sees the world the same way they do." So my question is, what practices do we need to take up so that we increase our ability to see the world through God's eyes?
All I can give you is what I've done, right? And other people will have done other things. But even in my tiny county, there's a lot of diversity. So I don't go to the Ingles grocery store. I go to the Thai Asian grocery store and just pick up things and take them to the cash register and say, "What is this? What is this?" If I lived in Atlanta, is the DeKalb Farmers Market still in business? That's where I'd go. So even during a pandemic, even in my little county, to visit neighborhoods where I don't know stuff and ask people to help me with stuff. As a teacher of world religions, I got regular semester by semester practice in that, visiting the wisdom traditions of the world and trying in some way to get far enough inside them as an outsider to convey that curiosity Bishop was talking about to the students, so that they want to know more, because they'd so often been taught only terrible things about people in other traditions. So literature, fiction, poetry, movies. I don't have a TV feed here, but I watch a ton of film. The Eagle Huntress, let me recommend that to anybody listening, a Mongolian 13-year-old girl who's the first to hunt with a golden eagle in her little part of Kazakhstan. And so, you know, all of those take me outside myself. They're all pretty tame and, you know, higher education oriented. Travel used to do that when I would go as far away as I could afford to go from home, Ethiopia, China, Peru. So there are many, many at home ways, like the Asian grocery store as well. But I'm interested to hear the two of you answer the same question. Am I allowed to do that?
Yeah, of course you are. Of course you're. Melissa, you go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Bishop. I'm not used to having the questions turned back on me. You know, when I read this, when we were preparing for our interview with you, honestly, a scripture passage came to mind. It was Isaiah 55. And it's especially Isaiah 55 verses 8-9. And it says this: "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts." And that imagery, along with the rest of the verse, to me, it's about seeking. Are we seeking God, or do we think we know God so well we can anticipate what God's going to be doing? I think when we start getting into the trap, if you will, of thinking we know what God is going to do or God could do, I think we're limiting the way God might show up in our lives. So to be able to see life through God's eyes, I think you nailed it, Barbara. I think the diversity factor and pulling ourselves out of our own experiences to experience new, I think that's one key way. Bishop, what do you think?
Yeah, a couple things come to mind. I think about Brian Stevenson's quote, which is sort of what Barbara talked about. It's all about proximity. Right. A little while ago before COVID, we were talking a lot about immigrants this and immigrants that and Hispanic people all throughout the middle of North Georgia. And I found that most of the experts on what the immigrants should do or shouldn't do and who they were didn't spend much time with immigrants. Right. Didn't mm-hmm. spend much time with people who were providing our meals and building our homes and, you know, cutting our grass, et cetera. And so, there's a holiness in proximity. Jesus models this wandering around Galilee all the time. He gets close to people, gets next to all kinds of people. And of course, this pisses off the religious community because there's revelation in proximity. So that's number one that occurs to me. Number two is I sort of come at it a little different, you know, being a person of color, raised in public housing in Pittsburgh through the late 60s and early 70s. So diversity for me was coming into a reality, a world where I had to make room for the idea that God loved the people who had benefited from slavery and who still enjoy the benefits of that generational wealth, et cetera. And so I would say that I sort of came to Virginia Seminary with a chip on my shoulder. And so the work for me was in the reverse. The work for me was to be able to acknowledge the superiority and separation I was maintaining and nurturing, enjoying, and to sort of and realize that that was inconsistent with the gospel. And so that has sort of been my journey. You know, again, it's all about context, all about, you know, family of origin and all that stuff. So that has been my journey is if in fact God is God of us all, you know, how do I live out the fact that you're my sibling? Realizing that all falls short and realizing that we have done terrible things to each other as members of the human family. But that has been my journey, and to be intentional about that and to get to the place where you can say that you love people across the board, it has been a struggle. I'm no saint, so I'm not all the way to the freedom side of the Red Sea, but I'm very clear that that's the work, and I've had some important mile markers on that journey.
What a flip in understanding. See, before you spoke, I was thinking about all the Torah laws about the stranger and the sojourner. You are alike before the Lord. You know, you shall love the stranger is in Torah, as well as love the neighbor. And yet the flip you just did is the ways in which I think if you're in a dominant group, you always think about the stranger, you look kind of down for the stranger, whereas the stranger may be hierarchically up, you know, or have a weapon in his or her hand. That's a helpful swap about whom do we identify as stranger, and it's not the dominant group, whatever that is. You also reminded me of a quote. I'm just aching to talk about Howard Thurman sometime, but he said, community can't long feed on itself. It can only flourish with the coming of others from beyond their unknown and undiscovered kin. I love that idea. And his community was what? Daytona Beach, Florida?
Daytona Beach, Florida. Yep.
I know.
Yep. Yep. Now, if you want to talk about Howard Thurman, we will be here for another 2 hours. I got to tell you.
Or just do a series, do a whole series on that. And I'll just tune in because he's enjoying a renaissance. I don't know if that's everywhere I turn, somebody's got a Howard Thurman quote, or they've read him, or they're doing a study group on Jesus and the Disinherited. It's incredible to me.
Yep. Well, you know, what's so amazing to me is that, you know, King wanted to be Thurman. King didn't want to be King. King wanted to be Thurman. I mean, he walked around with that book in his pocket. I mean, he wanted to sort of be a mystic and sit up and think big thoughts in the academy. God seemed to have other plans. You know, there's a revival in the mystics. I think there's a revival around people who can help us get past some of the smallness that infects what it means to be a person who's trying to follow after Jesus or follow God and by another name. And so I'm grateful for Thurman, C.T. Vivian. We just lost a mystic here in our midst in Atlanta. John Muir is someone who's important for me. I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, some would say to some degree or the other, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer was an existential mystic, whatever the hell that is, that was able to pick up threads of her community and to come boldly into invite people boldly into a new reality and embody that. So the mystics are important. I wonder, that makes me think, Barbara, that, you know, you up till a couple of years ago were at Piedmont College talking to young people. I'm interested in sort of what you said to them, being a person who's finds herself as part of the church, as a baptized person, as a priest of the church. But I'm also interested in what you heard there from young people about that encourages you and that discourages you about maybe the church's future.
Whoa, that's a big question.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Well, the first thing that came to mind was how much fun it was to teach a course on Christian mysticism. And you're going to have to define mystic later because somebody's going to ask me to do that soon and I won't be able to. but I assigned Howard Thurman, but I also assigned the Desert Fathers. And I'll never forget this young woman who came in the Tuesday after that. And she was holding up her Desert Fathers book. She said, "Who are these guys? They're great." They're just 4th-century Christian writers. So that part was fun. The difficulty with the question is there were students from a wide variety of traditions and none. You know, so I was in classrooms with Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, you know, wide variety of Pentecostal, Church of God, I mean, on and on and on. So I was really all of a sudden aware of what a small Episcopal vocabulary I had for speaking to a much wider group of Christians. But they were also all in college, which meant most of them were doing a necessary distancing dance from home and tradition and what they'd been taught. You know, they were engaging in Phyllis Tickle's famous rummage sale where they were putting everything on the lawn and deciding what would survive college or even freshman year. So what I heard from them that was encouraging is how eager they were once they got permission in a classroom to be curious about other ways of seeing ultimate reality, the sacred, the human place in the cosmos. They were so curious and they just wanted everything. They wanted to find kosher labels on food and they wanted to draw mandalas and they wanted to learn Indian dance and then they would leave class and clamp it down. And a couple of them got in terrible fights with their families because their family said they were being hoodwinked, you know, and why am I paying all this money? And why don't you take English classes and stop taking religion classes? So that was the disappointing part, was to watch curiosity blossom and then to watch it tamped down by the sort of guardians of their souls. And that's just a tiny bit of what comes to mind when you ask me that. But I was hugely encouraged. Every time people tell me, "Oh, what's the world coming to?" I think, "Oh, we've got great stuff coming up with, you know, the 19-year-olds I met are already blossoming into leaders."
Well, y'all, thanks so much for joining us this week with Four People. We were delighted to have the Reverend Barbara Brown Taylor with us this week, but this is just the first part of a 2-part series. So be sure to tune in next week.